Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 175 of Geek Town Radio. I'm back this week, and kind of back with me this week is Bex. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm about 50% there, as you can hear from my voice that sounds like I'm an extra in EastEnders. But I had no voice at all before, so to be honest, this is winning. 50% is more than zero.
Yes, that is true. You got struck down by a nasty case of conflu like one day into EGX this week. So
I was the originator of conflu, so I do apologise to everyone at EGX
fault.
That currently can't speak. I went to my best mate. 1-year-old's birthday party.
Ah, that'll do it.
And
yes,
of course, I am now patient zero. So I apologise to everyone else who now can't talk. But yes, I have 50% of my voice back, which meant I was about 50% capacity today. I have spent the whole of today on a improv comedy course.
Saying yes and quite a lot, yes.
There was quite a lot of that, yeah. And making numbers and pirate ships and stuff out of us in groups and all sorts of fun games, actually. It was it was good fun, actually. It really kind of shakes up what you're doing, and it's a good laugh. And things become funny accidentally quite a lot.
Cool. That's good. Any particular reason you decided to go into improv comedy?
It turns out that a lot of the YouTubers I have met recently that I really respect all are basically stand-ups or have been trained in improv or done that kind of thing. And I thought, people tell me I'm funnier in real life and on these podcasts than I am on camera because I go a little bit into work mode. And I was like, ah. Well, this sounds like a super fun, ridiculous way of becoming better at my job. So I did a taster lesson, and the taster lesson was hysterical. And then I said, oh, well, it's a shame that your course is booked up if anyone drops out. And they're like, actually, we've had one dropout.
So there you go.
Straight back from EGX, 4 hours sleep, no voice. Straight to improv class. And there's another geek there.
Oh, awesome.
There's another geek who is a lady who edits, I've forgotten the name of the website she edits for, but she spent the whole of last week at Thought Bubble, or telling me all about Thought Bubble and all of the amazing comics and stuff that they had up there. And she understands everything I say. It's brilliant.
That's brilliant. Awesome.
We just all of the references go in improv style.
So have you got anything else you want to bring up that you've been working on this week?
I'm trying to remember most of this week. I really have to say. I didn't have Netflix for a bit, which was sad, but a kind soul at the one-year-old birthday party has given me a Netflix login. So
oh, nice.
I can watch the rest of Disappointment, as I'm calling it. So that was the first three episodes of Disenchanted.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, at that point, I already renamed it Disappointment. I was going to make a YouTube video and found out I was like the 50th person to come up with that joke, so it probably wasn't worth it. But I was really surprised that it just wasn't that it was sweet and it was quite funny, but it wasn't that funny. It seemed to be not as many jokes as the Futurama or Simpsons. It just felt a lot slower.
I mean, I've watched a couple of episodes of it and I haven't gone back to it, which is not really a good sign. So
I was really surprised. I mean, I liked the animation, the setup quite cool, because obviously they've done the Simpsons in the present, the Futurama in the future, so having a kind of made up past type fantasy scenario seems like a good other place for them to explore. I quite like a few of the characters, Lucy especially, I quite liked, but it just, like, I feel like what I saw in the first three episodes could have been summed up in like a minute. I kind of like, you get it from the first minute, that's who she is, but she doesn't want to be a princess, she goes out drinking and gambling.
Yes,
I felt like they really kind of slowly introduce things that were pretty off the bat concepts, which is quite surprising. I'm used to things like Futurama where it's just like, hi, they're in space and get on with it.
Yeah, I think that was my feeling as well, was they were stretching it quite a lot. So, which is a bit of a shame.
I mean, it could pick up in the next half of the series. It could be one of those ones that they just haven't found their feet yet. But
Well,
the second half of the first series, it would be, wouldn't it? Because it was part one of the first section of the series. But yeah, I will finish watching it and kind of see it through, I think. But yeah, I needed Netflix back. And someone told me that the season of Star Trek was out and they lied.
Not yet. Not yet. It'll be January.
I think they just told me that because I said I didn't have a Netflix login and they just wanted to torture me.
That's January. That's going to be, I think.
I think I'm one of the few people I know that actually liked it. I mean, I thought that the I don't want to spoil things for people if they haven't seen it, but I wasn't keen on the ending.
Right. Yes. Try not to spoil things. I got told off for putting too many spoilers in the podcast last week. So
I'm not saying what happened. I'm just saying that I wasn't keen.
Yes, how they ended it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, I quite like that, but I can see why.
I still enjoyed quite a lot of it, even though I can see the argument of it not entirely Star Trek.
Yes,
except for that Groundhog Day episode, which is probably my favourite episode. Which doesn't spoil anything to say that, but there is a Groundhog Day episode, which is amazing.
Yes, that is good, that one. Well, I mean, we've got the new Patrick Stewart series coming soon, and he tweeted out a picture of him sat in the writing room today. So that's something to look forward to, and that will be definitely be solid Star Trek, I think. So look forward to that. Stuff for me this week, I've been ploughing through various new shows. I have to give a quick mention to Bodyguard, which of course just finished on BBC last night. They announced the numbers this morning. It got a 47.9% audience share yesterday. That's half the TV audience were basically watching BBC One to watch Bodyguard, which is unheard of for a drama. 10.4 million, it peaked at 11 million on sort of live viewing, which is phenomenal. So
nothing would beat Bake Off.
Yeah. I mean, it's that you're getting up towards sort of World Cup numbers with that. I mean, it's insane for drama, really quite insane. It's been like the biggest show on the TV. So I suspect we're going to have more seasons of that, although they haven't officially said that yet. Going back onto Netflix, Maniac, which is this new limited series that's out at the moment, which is truly strange, really quite odd. It's Emma Stone and Jonah Hill, and they're playing two people who end up in this drug trial, in this pharmaceutical trial, and things don't quite go the way they should do, basically. But the entire setup for it is particularly strange because it's sort of an alt reality where you've got weird little robots that sort of clean up after your pets, and the Statue of Liberty isn't the Statue of Liberty. So it's this odd kind of other world place. So it already sets you off in this kind of weird dreamlike state. And it's shot in sort of a way that enforces that as well. It's really quite odd. It's a very strange series. I've only a couple of episodes into it at the moment. I'm looking forward to seeing more of it. I just haven't got around to it yet. It's weird, wonderful, and I advise you to go watch it because it is one of the strangest shows you'll see this year, I think.
I think that's going to have to go on my list now because I've heard about it and stuff, but with not having Netflix, I hadn't actually got around to watching a lot of stuff. But I think, anything like that that kind of takes the world, puts a little bit of a twist on it and makes it a slightly surreal version. Like the thing with humans on Channel 4. It's our world, but not quite.
Yeah, and it's very much that sort of thing. It's got a sort of Black Mirror-esque kind of slight shunt into a different reality feel about it, you know. It's very much that sort of thing. Also on Netflix, I watched the first episode of The Good Cop, which is a police procedural starring Tony Danza and Josh Groban. It's Tony Danza as the sort of senior cop who's a reformed dirty cop who's just been sort of let out of prison and he's living with his son, who is a very kind of uptight, by-the-book police officer. It's pretty much a standard network police procedural. It doesn't seem to fit quite rightly on Netflix. It's a bit of an odd show to be on Netflix. It's perfectly fine. It's very kind of, you know, Castle-esque or that sort of those sort of dramedy police procedural things. It's very much in that mold.
Okay. Not going for realism then, but going more for the character development approach.
Yeah, it's much more in the vein of things like Instinct and that sort of thing. It's funny. It's entertaining enough. It's a bit of an odd thing to end up on Netflix. I have a feeling it maybe was originally developed for a network and then didn't land and they picked it up on Netflix, which is possibly why it feels like that. Perfectly fine show from what I saw of it. Just seems a bit, it's not the sort of thing you expect off a Netflix show, but worth going to watch if you like those sort of procedural dramas. Killing Eve, which just started on BBC. The whole thing is actually up on iPlayer, so you can go watch through it, which is what I did, because that is a brilliant, brilliant series. Very much a cat and mouse game between Sandra Oh, who plays this MI5 agent, and she is tracking down this serial killer who is seemingly a sort of hitman for hire, or in this case a hit woman, played by Jenny Comer. Sandra Oh's character is Eve and is somewhat obsessed by the sort of psychopathic assassin. The psychopathic assassin has also become slightly obsessed with her as well. So there are a few scenes together, but not many, but you get this sort of this cat and mouse thing of them chasing after each other. It's really good. It's very funny. It's very twisted. It's very Phoebe Waller-Bridger, who is the person that came up with it. It's very much her sort of thing. Just superb from start to finish. It's 8 episodes long. Well worth going to watch if you've not watched that. I would thoroughly recommend it. It's one of the best things on TV right now. I highly recommend that. And then the Captain Marvel trailer came out this week.
Yeah, that's got a lot of people arguing in comment sections at the moment about the grandma.
Yes, punching the grandma in the face. Yes.
The amount of people commenting on the thing, just saying someone didn't learn to respect their elders, or people like querying it. Yes. I think most of the comments I've seen about it have been about the grandpa.
Yes, yeah, that is true.
I'm not sure if that was intentional on their part.
I'm sure it was.
I mean, it's definitely become a bit of a thing. I'm expecting that grandma to become a meme.
Yeah, I have seen it being memed already, so it is becoming a meme. I really like the look of this. I think it's going to be an interesting way to kick off the... Well, I mean, it sort of overlaps, but it sort of kicks off the next phase of the MCU. Although technically there is another movie coming after it, I think this is really the start of the next phase. Yeah, so
I'm assuming they're going to use her in place of Adam for the next part of Infinity War.
Yeah.
Instead, they're not introducing Adam, who was teased at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy. I've forgotten the name of the gold race, but they make him. And he was teased at the end, in the post-credits of that.
Right, yeah.
I kind of assumed he was going to be in the second part of Infinity War, because in the comics, he's very important
right.
in the finale to that story. And then they were like, no, he's not turning up until the next Guardians of the Galaxy. But then after Infinity War, so I'm assuming that Captain Marvel is going to be very big.
I would guess. And at the moment, of course, we're assuming there is going to be another Guardians movie with all the stuff that's going on with that. So we'll have to wait and see.
And if they don't end up doing that, and the guy that was teased as Adam, who's looking forward to being Adam for like all this time, doesn't get to do it, I will have so much sympathy for that poor guy. Like, your entire role in the Marvel movies is to be a post-credit teaser that never pans out.
Yeah, that would be
so unfortunate.
That
yeah, when you think you're going to be like a major character who's like pretty OP as well. He's a pretty like crazy power guy. So I'm curious to see how they're going to be jigsaw puzzling these pieces all together.
Yes.
And I'm curious about if Captain Marvel is going to be, cause just looking at the, you know, it's a short trailer, it doesn't give too much away, but has she been brainwashed? Is that what's happening? Because she's all
expressionless
and, you know.
I don't know whether she's brainwashed, but they do seem to imply that she has sort of forgotten about her earthen past. So
or
I don't know.
Amnesiac, brainwashed, or some other control mechanism.
Maybe.
In comic books, the kind of like the hero's forgotten his memories and become a bad guy is a really very overused trope. So really hasn't been used that much in the Marvel movies, but I'm hoping there's a bit of a twist on it.
Yes, yeah.
And I'm curious to see. I'm happy that they haven't given too much away in the trailer.
Yeah.
Because I have found that in recent years, I watch a trailer and go, well, now I can, as someone who reads comics, I can totally figure the whole movie out from this. And I had to sort of stop watching trailers.
Yes, I'm a bit like that.
I'm intrigued by this one.
Yeah, I'm a bit like that. I sort of watched the first one, but try and avoid watching any of the others. Otherwise, you end up seeing half the movie before you actually get in to watch it. So, yes, I'm very much with you on that. And the other bit of news that landed the last couple of days, Telltale Games have closed, apparently. These are the makers of the Walking Dead games, and I think they had a Guardians of the Galaxy game in development, and they did the Batman games as well. Not the Arkham ones, the point-and-click storyteller people, which is quite sad. Although, I mean, it sounds like they weren't treating their staff particularly well, but yeah, I'm sort of sad to see them go.
Well, normally what happens with these things is that a collective of people from that company will set up a small studio.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that will happen, and we'll see some more interesting
talents that were making the games that we were enjoying will make another little company or team up or join another collective.
Yeah.
And these people do tend to form groups and pop back up. So I think there's hope that, you know, even if the games they were currently working on won't come out, that similar things will appear.
Yeah, I mean, the most disappointing thing I think for fans will be the fact that it looks like the final season of the Walking Dead games aren't going to arrive. They're going to do episode one, episode two, and it'll just stop, which is that's unfortunate, because it's like having a TV show cancelled mid-season and they're not going to end rounding up the story, which is that looks to be the case at the moment. Whether that license, you know, another company forms and that license gets passed across and they manage to finish it, I don't know, but yeah, that's really a shame. So, you know, I feel sorry for fans of those games more than anything else, but hopefully we'll see something come out of that. But as we've gotten to gaming, as we mentioned earlier, we have spent the last 4 days on and off at EGX. So let's go on and talk a little bit about EGX now.
It was 4 days of epic. I've not been to a big EGX before.
Yeah, it was...
I've been to the red one in London, but not the big one. Yeah, there was 4 days of stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those rare occasions. EGX is a huge gaming convention, which is in Birmingham, for those of people that don't know. Yeah, it's one of those rare occasions where the big version of the show is actually the Birmingham one and not the London one for a change. But it is huge. I mean, there really is 4 days of stuff to go around. And it's not just the big games. There's a lot of interesting little indie games, and I mean, I think both of us spent probably most of our time in the indie section more than anywhere else.
I always spend my time mostly in the indie section, because obviously that's a lot of what I like to cover and the people I like to interview. I did wander over to the retro section and get told off because I didn't want to stop playing on the Tempest arcade cabinet they had and they wanted to turn it off, but I wasn't dead yet. I adore Tempest, but if you haven't played it, it's an isometric 3D-ish, it's early 80s, isn't it? I can't remember.
Something like that, yes. It's a fairly early one.
If I wasn't so tired, I'd know. But it's a game of my childhood, and it's a game. I had Tempest 2000 on the Atari Jaguar, but there's something about playing it on an arcade cabinet because it has a dial control which you turn around.
I remember.
Allows you to move your, I say ship, inverted commas, it's like a little triangle, around these grids and shoot, which means you can spin the ship round and round and round, which is very different to playing on a D-pad on a console. So there's something pretty awesome about the arcade cabinet for that. And they were sort of saying the show is now closed. And I was like, but other than that, though, mostly in the indie section, which was huge and phenomenal. The range and the talent and the games they had were incredible. And they had big proper stands and, you know, indie VR games and massive 8-player multiplayer games, couch games going on. And it was great. And I think we had some similar top picks as well.
Yeah, I mean, first one, if we're going to talk about the indie games, I will say before we get into the indie games, actually, I did play the one sort of AAA main game. There was two. There's Two Point Hospital, which I've been obsessed about recently. And I went and played that, purely went and sat down on the stand to play that for a little bit. So they give me a T-shirt. So I now have a Two Point Hospital T-shirt. So I played that. But that's brilliant. If you're ever a fan of Theme Hospital, go and play Two Point Hospital. title. It's superb. The other game that I actually went in and made sure that I got a bit of time with was Life is Strange 2, which is a completely new story from Life is Strange 1. Again, very much in that sort of point and click kind of setup, much like the first one was. You get about 20 minutes with it, so it was sort of pretty much the same sort of thing, just introducing the characters and stuff. So I don't know what the mechanics are in terms of, you know, they had powers and things where she could rewind time in the first game, and I don't know what the sort of powers and stuff and special things they're going to be in the second game, because you didn't get that far. But I mean, it looks nice, it looks great, it's going to be quite an interesting story, so it was nice to get my hands on that for a little bit. In terms of the indie games, we should probably kick off by giving a shout out to Miamau Castle.
Who I was helping understand for a bit with them. Space Harrier, Love Letter, flying magical cat dragon that collects rainbows that you move with your hand using a neat motion controller.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously addictive.
I had an actual go of it because I'm aware of this game because, you know, Quang, who is one of the creators of it, you know quite well, and you've done videos with him before.
Everyone knows the Sobi Tech. Miamau Castle's been at 52 shows.
Yes. So I imagine most people have, you know, if you've ever seen an indie game, the chances are you've come across Miamau Castle. It's great fun. Using the Leap controller is really intuitive and works really well for that game, which you just sort of wave your hand around and it moves the flying magical cat dragon around, and you make a fist and he goes faster. And I mean, it's really fun and thoroughly enjoyable. I really enjoy playing that. So, you know, that's worth checking out if it's around. They're making a mobile version of it, I noticed, according to the website.
Yeah, it works on mobile and it works on trackpad as well.
Right, okay.
It does all sorts. You can fly cat dragons and all sorts of things. Right. It's great watching it, because I kind of like lure people up to the store and I'm like, do you want to pilot a cat dragon? You know you want to, because they're looking at it in crazy pixely sort of retro stylings. They're looking at it and I'm like, yeah. And they always do the first level where you're just collecting a few rainbows and they're like, this is easy. And then it gets faster and faster and faster and there's more obstacles. And then I'm like, oh, didn't quite make it to the end. Do you want to go again? And they're like, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really good fun.
It's good to watch people. It's good to watch little kids playing that as well.
Yes, yeah, totally. Because it's
especially
nice
when they
and easy
beat their parents on the high score.
Awesome. So yeah, I mean that's really good fun. Sticking with the retro gaming, I mean they had this was in the Left Field area, and the Left Field area really was games that were fairly left of field. So Miamau Castle was in there. Tanglewood was another game that was in there, and this is a brand new game for the Sega Mega Drive and Genesis. Yeah. And by that we don't mean it's going to run on an emulator, although I think it does run on an emulator, but it's not just that. It's literally he's manufactured and created a cartridge which will go in a genuine Sega Mega Drive system. It's a proper 8-bit game. He learnt the language for it. It was built on a proper Sega development kit. I mean, it's crazy what he's actually dedicated himself to do for this.
Yeah, you can see why I pulled you over to have a go on that. And they were incredibly kind enough to give me a cartridge, a press review cartridge, so I'm going to be able to play the game in full and do a proper video on it and check, because it's a beautiful game as well. Like, a labour of love, and it shows in every frame of it.
Yeah, it really is. Matt Phillips is the guy that is behind that game. We actually had a little chat with him, so here's a little interview with Matt just talking a bit more about Tanglewood and how he developed it. So tell me your name and what the game is.
Hi, my name's Matt Phillips. I'm working on Tanglewood, which is a brand new game for the Sega Mega Drive.
That's something you don't hear very often. What on earth possessed you to make a game for the Sega Mega Drive?
It's something I wanted to do since I was a kid, and I just didn't grow up, really. it's a dream that never left me. Something I wanted to do all the way through as childhood, all the way through my teens. Never really got the opportunity until recently, so I grabbed at it, and I'm actually doing it.
It's beautifully done. I mean, you've done a stunning job with it, and it's not only is it a game for a Mega Drive, it is literally a game for a Mega Drive, not an emulator, it's written in the same code base, it's in a cartridge. It is genuinely a Mega Drive game.
Yeah, it's created using equipment, technology, languages, processes of the 90s. We've got an original Mega Drive development kit from 1993, which we used to write the engine. We use all the original tools running MS-DOS. We write the whole thing in assembly language. And we write all our own level editors and animation editors like they would have done back in the 90s. We're also producing it using original 90s EEPROM chips. So the cartridges themselves have got 90s tech in them too.
That's insane. Where do you find the cartridges at this point?
Most of it we had to manufacture ourselves. The shells for the cartridges, we had to have a mold machined. Because we don't have access to Sega's original presses or anything like that. The PCBs we had to have custom designed. The EEPROM chips are original 90s chips we found in a warehouse in China. There's a massive stash of them. And the printed materials we had all done locally. The cases we had imported from the States. It's been an absolute nightmare to arrange the physical manufacture, but it's as close to 90s authentic as we can get, so it's been very much worth it.
The development kit is, what, one of two left in the world or something?
One of two working that we know of.
Okay.
We haven't seen many around. Yeah. One went on eBay a couple of weeks ago and it hit upwards of 15 grand. I keep mine very tightly under wraps now.
Yeah, don't blame you.
But as far as I'm aware, there are only two full working sets that I can find. Obviously, there's probably more out there in studio basements or on shelves somewhere, but to actually find the entire thing working is quite rare.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the game itself, you play like this this little fox and you're sort of wandering through this very beautifully done woodland. How did you come up with the idea for the game?
Inspirations from lots of the games that I've played throughout the years, really. I've always been a fan of platformers all the way back through my Sonic days. I love Flashback, Another World, those kind of games. PlayStation years, I loved Abe's Odyssey, Heart of Darkness, Rayman, that sort of thing. Even modern games, I love anything by Playdead, Limbo, Inside, that sort of thing. So platformers have just been with me since childhood, and I knew if I was ever going to write my own game on this thing, it had to be a platformer. And it draws in all sorts of inspirations from Abe's Odyssey and Another World, things like that. But there's quite a lot of other games in there, just reflavored for my own purposes.
Where can people find more information if they want to find out about it?
You can buy it on Steam. That comes with a ROM file, so if you want to play on a Mega Drive emulator, you can do.
So,
Tanglewood on Steam, or if you want to pre-order a cartridge, it's tanglewoodgame.com.
Awesome. Well, I hope you sell loads of cartridges. I'm sure there's people got Mega Drives kicking around in their loft and stuff that they aren't using. So.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Awesome. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So that was Matt Phillips from Tanglewood. You can go and check that out. I think tanglewoodgame.com, I think, is the address for that. So go and check that out, because it is quite phenomenal. If you've got a Sega Mega Drive kicking around, you can go and order it as well on the actual cartridge version and get a brand new game for your like 20-year-old console or whatever it is. So well worth it, though.
I have to add in another one from the Left Field collection, which I'm surprised you haven't flagged up in your notes as well.
Did you
play the book ritual?
I didn't, because it was so crowded every time I got near it, but I did watch some people play it. Explain the book ritual, because it's a crazy game.
The book ritual is a interactive, very emotive story where you are just following through the story, and it sounds just kind of like, oh, this is just something where you're just reading some text and you're talking to a book.
Yes.
But the book is very, very convinced it used to be a person. And in order to remember the lost memories it had when it used to be a person and to gain its identity back, it needs you to take the actual physical book of it. And when it asks you, you have to write certain things about yourself and put down information, sometimes quite poignant information about yourself, and then feed the page to it, which is basically a shredder that they've decorated up to be this kind of cookie monster made of books, is the best kind of description for it. And
yes,
you feed it a page, and they've got a feedback thing where it has a sensor to know it's fed the page and what you put in, and it tells the game that you've done it, and then the game can progress. And it's fascinating because in some ways it's the simplest gameplay in the world. But because you're destroying a book, although they did have copies of Katie Price books and Fifty Shades and stuff as well. There's a random selection of books.
Yeah.
Some of which I was less worried about shredding than others, let's say. And you feel this permanence about what you're doing, and you wanted to do it as making a connection with player and getting an emotional, where people were getting very invested and were trying, you know, they wanted to sit and play the whole story and see it through because it's such an emotive thing. It's really clever. The guy who does it, his name I've temporarily forgotten, I'm afraid, does these really interesting games that connect to you on another level, normally with like physical kind of things that you have to do outside of the game. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
One of the other ones that was good fun, although really, really, really stupid, was a game called Sticky Cats. Did you spot that one?
I did. I don't think I played that one either, but that was in the left field section as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was another one in the left field, which was, I'm not saying it hasn't got a longevity, I don't think, of the other games, but it involves trying to do things with cats that are basically like covered in glue. And I've got some video somewhere of some people who were just so hysterically into this game that one of them is just yelling, "No, stupid cat! No, the stupid cat!" And just, the two of them are just in utter hysterics. And that's what some of the left field stuff does, is it's the play mechanisms and the story and the emotion of them. They're really out there. They're stuff that would never get published by anyone else.
Yeah.
And every now and again, there's just genius on, either being something kind of permanent that really affects you, like people were having with the book ritual, or just hysterical falling over laughter like they were with a Sticky Cats game.
The left field section was by far the most overall interesting area, I think, just for the there was another one where you played the game by tuning in an old CRT TV as well, which was particularly weird. I mean, there were all sorts of wonderfully bizarre, strange controllers and weird games and odd off-the-wall sort of ideas in that section. So, I mean, there were some great things in there. The other cool stand that was there was the tentacle stand, had like big green tentacles sort of coming out of the top of it. One of the games that was over there, they had a number of things which we'd seen before, like Honey, I Joined a Cult, which we talked to the guys from that a few weeks ago because they were at Insomnia. That was in there. One next to them actually was called the Collage Atlas, which was absolutely stunning.
It's hard to describe how beautiful that game was to look at.
Yeah, it's entirely hand-drawn. It's done in sort of ink and it looks like technical pens, so they're very kind of fine ink drawings.
Black and white as well.
Yeah.
So it's really limited colour height, really simple, really beautiful.
All hand-drawn, then sort of scanned in to make this wonderful dreamlike picture book sort of world. It's a sort of first-person adventure, and you kind of walk through and you discover various different areas. What's quite interesting is he chose not to put clicks into anything for interacting with stuff. So you interact with things by sort of the point of view you're looking at. Like, you know, there might be letters floating in the air and you stand in a particular place and the letters form a word and that sort of thing. It was really interesting and cleverly done. I'm looking forward to seeing a little bit more of that. That was a guy called John Evelyn from Robot House, that one is. But that's called the Collage Atlas, and I think it's thecollageatlas.com if you want to go and find more about that. One of the other games I came across, which was a bit more of a sort of traditional game, Beyond Blue. I don't know, did you spot this one?
I saw it, but I didn't have a chance to play it, but they did give me a card to get a press copy to play for that as well. So
oh, great.
It won one of the best in show from Jupiter Hadley as well, who's an indie game reviewer. She gave it one of her stars for the top 10, I think.
Yeah, I really like this game. It's from the Eline Media, who are the makers of Never Alone, if you played that. You play a part of a crew who are looking through a largely uncharted ocean, and it's just beautifully done. There's sort of creatures floating around. It's all kind of fairly real world like as well, in terms of the creatures that are down there, the flora and fauna, and it's very heavily inspired by the Blue Planet series, and they're actually working with BBC Studios as well. But it's just stunning. I mean, I was sort of drawn to it because I love Subnautica, and it's very much not that, actually. You know, Subnautica is a sort of underwater survival game, and this isn't really quite as much that sort of thing. It seems to be more about the sort of discovery. I only play played it for like 10 minutes. They had a very small demo that was there. So it's not out yet. They're still working on it. I think they're talking about releasing next year, or I'm not sure whether that's a full release or an early access release next year. But it's definitely one worth going to look out for. But that's called Beyond Blue. I thought that was absolutely stunning and really, really worth looking at. One of the other games I came across was a city builder, which was called Flotsam. It has the minor disadvantage that you're building your city on the top of an ocean. So you're building it out of...
Waterworld style.
You're building a floating garbage town, essentially. So you have a sort of starting point and you have to build out from that, and you're scavenging debris as it sort of floats past you, and you build up this large city, essentially. I mean, this is sort of pre-alpha what they bought, but what they have done is so beautifully crafted. I mean, you could sit and watch the waves and the stuff under it and just sit and watch that for hours. It was, you know, so nicely done. And the little animations on all the little things that you build. And I love city builders. And this is actually, if you look for Flotsam up on Steam, it's worth going to, I think, follow that and wishlist it, because if you're into city builders, because I think that's going to be a fabulous one. It's from a company called Pajama Llama Games, which is also completely awesome as a name for a company.
Yeah, I mean, I think if that's the name of your company, you're just winning from the get-go, really.
Yes, totally.
There was one a game with a pretty brilliant name called Nature's Zombie Apocalypse.
Right.
Which is what happens when all the humans have become zombies.
Yes.
Well, obviously, there's only animals left, and they'll just step up. So it's up to 8-player couch co-op, and yes, you can play things like a bear wearing a tiara holding a machine gun.
Yes.
Or a duck holding a baseball bat with its wing and a pirate hat. You can even be a goldfish bowl with a gun. It just hops around. Incredibly silly. Incredibly funny.
Very silly.
Chaotic, fun nonsense.
Yes, that was quite good. We actually played that for a bit, I think, didn't we?
I dragged you over to show you.
Yes, it's wonderfully silly, that game. It's a great sort of, you know, multi-person couch player, that one, I think.
I had a couple of goes at Catastronauts, which is a bit like Overcooked Meat Space.
Yes.
Which is up to, I think it's 4 players for that one, couch co-op, and you are trying to keep your space from being on fire and yourself from being on fire, and occasionally shoot guns and keep everything going in a very chaotic way. That's another one that's incredibly good fun.
I didn't get to play that one. It looked, I watched a little bit of it. It reminds me very much of something like FTL, which is a great game on Steam. It's not co-op though, FTL, but it's a similar sort of...
I think they describe it themselves as Overcooked meets FTL.
Yes, so that's very much what it looked like from what I saw, which is, you know, they're great games. They're both great games, so, you know, that's a perfectly fine thing to base it off, I think.
Yeah, and that's incredibly good fun. And the animations, like when you're running around on fire and you're trying to like charge up batteries, and then like solar flares start coming and you've got to go and run into the safe room and all get into the room and shut the door, or you'll die instantly. And then if people die, you've got to clone them to bring them back as a respawn method. It's chaos, but that was really, really good. And then in complete contrast to the other end of the scale, I played Arca's Path on, which is a VR indie game.
Right, yes.
Which is one of the most relaxing, beautiful, zen-like stories driven puzzle game that you control just with your head, I can think of.
Right, yes.
Which is a young girl living in a post-apocalyptic wasteland finds a mark, and it's a headset, and it transports her to this world, and you're just controlling a ball effectively in a kind of puzzle maze, but there's also this big storyline going on as well, and everyone that was playing it said it was like meditating.
Oh, wow.
Just, I mean, it's challenging, but it's also incredibly beautiful and ridiculously accessible, because you don't need to be able to hold a controller. All you need to be able to do is move your head a small amount, and the more you move your head, the faster the ball will roll, kind of thing. It was really just calming and lovely. And another one, in fact, that was had a similar sort of feel, although slightly less meditative and more smashing stuff, was a Soundfall. I don't know if you had a go at that one.
No, I don't think I did.
It's a game which is like a dungeon crawler, but sort of in a kind of fantasy type world, but everything you do is to the beat of the music. So if you strike the enemy with a sword or shoot your gun on beat with the music playing, it's more powerful, so you start getting to a rhythm. And if you want to traverse the landscape, you have to do it on beat with the music, so you can have up to 4 of you doing these things, and it changes the kind of soundscape of the game, and
oh, wow,
the visuals become slightly more vibrant when you're more powerful, and really lovely. And you kind of, people would go up to it and they'd be a bit confused, and then once you've got it, you just got into this flow of playing it, and it just made so much sense. And I'm not sure I've seen effectively a dungeon crawler crossed with a rhythm game before.
Yeah.
And the graphics were beautiful as well. The art style was gorgeous. I forgot the name of the artist they were working with, but just the whole thing was really, really lovely. I was crazy impressed by so many of the games.
That's really interesting. It's what I love about the indie section is you do get this wonderful sort of cross of some that are far more traditional sort of games, but really nice and maybe have a slightly different slant, and some which are completely out there and just look at things from an entirely different direction that you wouldn't necessarily get a mainstream publisher involved with. So it's great. I love the fact that you get this whole wide array of stuff. It's good. So the last game that we'll talk about is, for me, it was my game of the show. I absolutely love this. It was called The Bradwell Conspiracy. You didn't actually get a chance to play this, did you? I don't think.
I was gutted I didn't get a chance to play this, actually, because I just loved everything about their stall and the way they had the marketing with just like the bottles of water.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like, as if like nothing to see here, nothing is really sinister over here.
Yeah.
It worked so well, just because like having like the bottles of water with their logo on to give to people, with the, you know, the fictional company logo on. The yeah. Corporation.
Yeah.
Like just that alone, I was sold and I didn't even get to play the game.
They also had some very cool Stonehenge hats on as well, which were great.
Yeah.
Had those kicking around. So the Bradwell Conspiracy, it's from a company called A Brave Plan and Bossa Studios, who are the publisher. On the surface, I would say it's a little bit Portal. It's a little bit something like the Stanley Parable. It's a narrative-driven adventure puzzle game. It's set in a sort of alt-near future in the fictional New Stonehenge Museum. The idea is that you are a voiceless character because you've inhaled smoke, so that's why you can't talk. You're visiting the museum one day, there is an explosion, you start to dig yourself out of the rubble, and the only thing you've really got to help you are some AR glasses, which are sort of the tour guide glasses. Those are the only things that you really have to help you to give you hints. And whilst you're wandering around, you get contacted by Amber, who is another survivor trapped behind a locked door. But of course, you're unable to speak because you've inhaled smoke, so you've got no voice. So the only way you can communicate with Amber is by taking photos of your environment, and she will sort of help you out because she is apparently an employee of Bradwell Electronics, who are the company that own the museum. Bradwell Electronics are quite a sort of interesting setup as well. They actually have a website up for bradwellelectronics.com, which is well worth going to look at. You're sort of taken into this mystery as you and Amber are trying to work together to get out of the museum. And you also get some another device slightly later on, which is a sort of matter converter, like a portable 3D printer. So you can get blueprints for the matter converter, and that allows you to make planks that will get you from like point A to point B, and various other, and weights and things and various other stuff. I spent about 40 minutes playing the first sort of 40 minutes of this game. I loved it. I really thought it was beautifully done. It's very British. It's got this wonderful sort of British sense of humour to it. It's exactly the sort of single player puzzle adventure game that I absolutely adore. It's got a nice story to it. It's intriguing. It's got a great voice cast as well, including some people you may recognise. I actually had a chance to sit down and talk with the developers of this as well, who is George Backer and Holly Pickering. We did about 15-minute interview with them, so they talk a little bit more about the game, but honestly, I thought it was absolutely fabulous. So here's George and Holly.
Probably start off by you introducing yourself and the game.
Okay, my name is George Backer, and I'm the game director on The Bradwell Conspiracy.
So I've just been sat playing through The Bradwell Conspiracy. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's completely my sort of game. Just for people that haven't heard about it yet, do you want to give a brief explanation of the game?
Yes, it is a first-person adventure game about two strangers who have to work together to escape a rather dangerous situation, and by doing that, uncover a bit of a conspiracy. That's how I would put it, I think.
Yeah, that kind of covers it.
Does it come across like that?
Yeah, I mean, I playing through the first couple of levels, which is what you brought with you, portal-esque, I think, if you were trying to describe it to somebody, and on the certainly on the initial opening levels, which is no bad thing as far as I'm concerned, because I adore that game. And but I can see where the differences are. I particularly like the mechanic of him not talking and you using photos. Where did that idea come from?
So there's two things about it. I think we first wanted to make sure that we can have a player character that does not never referred to by name or gender. So you don't even, like, you know, it's interesting you said him, because obviously you put yourself in that situation, which is great. But also talking to NPCs is always a tough one, I think.
Yeah.
And I was very, very initially, when the initial idea was like, I don't want to do dialogue trees, and I don't want to do a game where you just press the button to advance the dialogue that is pre-given. So that was the two conditions. And so I had an idea of the photo thing a while ago, and then Holly and I, we worked together in the project. Holly, the art director, Holly Pickering, she's like the first collaborator who came on board, and we created this prototype, and we were like, well, we'll do the photo thing, but we'll probably need some other mode as well, because we weren't sure if that just would work on the photo thing. And then we realized it just would work with photos, which is great, which is a great relief as well. So we didn't need anything else. But before that, we're like, okay, how can we combine a photo mode with something else? But yeah, and then we realized it worked, and we just like, you know, we're going to keep it, even if that means we have to write thousands of lines of dialogue for all the different variations and mutations. And, you know, and, cause we track quite a bit in the game, like what Amber has seen, what you've sent her, so she can react to that later on and whatnot. So there's a lot of that going on as well. But it was born out of the necessity to find something else, find something more immersive, more that gives you more agency as a player, but also that allows us to be more, allows us to not have to define the player character. You know, so you're not like John Doe, who's so the whole game is set up that it could happen to anyone, and that makes sense.
The game is set in the Stonehenge Museum. That's the setting for it. Where did the idea of doing that, and why particularly the Stonehenge Museum?
So it's the new Stonehenge Museum, so not the real Stonehenge Museum. it's like it's all fictional. Like, you know, there's no real timeline. I think the setting, I think we wanted to do very strong British, very like British heritage. Yeah. You never hardly ever see that, which is bizarre, I think, you know, in these kind of like mystery thriller type games. And I don't know why, because we've got such a nice, you know, there's a lot of mystery around the UK and or in the UK. And it just worked really well. And for what we wanted to do with the story, all the stuff that the whole story entails that I can't spoil, it just felt like the right place to do it as well. And also, funny enough, is like the government at the moment, you know, they're considering things like doing an under a tunnel bypass of the A303?
Oh, A3,
yeah, all that stuff. And we're like, this is great. You know, we're going to use all of this. Like the idea that this would happen, because the game plays about 10 years in the future, and the assumption is that had been done and there had been stuff discovered and all that. You know, right. So it's a kind of like, it's sort of like this. The cave system is being discovered, which, and then we just took it from there. We're like, well, we just take what's going to happen anyway and just add a little bit to it, and then we can tie it in. And so, which is great, because every time the BBC News had an update on like, oh, that traffic problem in Salisbury and around Stonehenge, when is the tunnel going to be built? We're like, this is great, do it more. Like, so yeah, that was another thing I think that just helped.
We were talking earlier about the voice cast. I don't know whether you want to reveal who the voices are. I think it's been mentioned in some of the press already. Do you want to just talk a bit about how the voice cast got involved?
Okay, so we have quite a really cool voice, because like Amber is played by Rebecca Lotchance, who's from Broadway background. She's comes from the Broadway theatre, and she's fantastic. And it's her first game, I think.
Really?
And and we've got Kate Sexton, who's our performance director, and she comes from theatre and TV and games as well. Like, she's done Alien Isolation, the performance direction for that game.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and Mafia 3, and I worked with her on Fable, so it was a really nice, get somebody involved who knows how to work and get performance out. And then we have Abu Kabar Salim, who's the voice of the guide, and he's been Assassin's Creed Origins, for example, you know. And then also we have as a cameo Jonathan Ross. Also, we've asked him if he wouldn't mind doing a cameo, and he did that for like a very important section of the game, but we needed to go over the top of this section.
Yes.
So many things.
Exactly.
I think
the right voice.
Yeah. and I think he totally delivered on that as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a huge kind of gaming fan anyway, so I imagine it was completely yes.
It was lucky. Obviously, that's always nice when they say yes, sir.
You bought the first couple of levels with you. You're in kind of bug fixing at the moment, so the rest of the game is sort of complete at the moment.
I mean, Holly and I were in the team. We're just polishing and fixing bugs and polishing and fixing bugs and probably getting people to play this game and writing down notes and going like, oh, you know, is this it's all the feedback that because we have only announced it like 2 weeks ago. I can't even, which is just seeing what people. How people is. So we will need a little bit more time to get all that sorted. Yeah. We haven't announced the release date yet, but we want to go multi-platform and Bossa, thankfully, is dealing with all of that, which is nice. So they're like, you guys focus on finishing this game. We'll focus on the other bits and pieces.
That's good. Yeah. It's good.
Add something to the Britishness of this, which I really like, because also it's Holly's inspiration from art, because as an art director point of view, you'll see like a lot of like the brutalist thing, you know, this kind of a brutalist concrete...
Yeah,
it's very British stuff. So that was also a conscious decision. I shouldn't answer Holly's hang on. I think
Holly
I feel like
sat next to you, could answer herself.
I think I'll just defer to Holly now.
Just on that. So something that was really important for us in terms of like the backstory of the game and kind of like the whole Britishness thing of like why Stonehenge and all of this thing. We kind of wanted to make an alternate reality, which in the UK we used to have such a strong hardware background in terms of like when we used to have like Acorn and the BBC Micro, all of these sorts of things. We're like, what if Apple had come out of that background instead of coming out of Silicon Valley?
Right.
And so like there's Bradwell Electronics and, you know, the idea if they had become the world standard for electronics and, you know, what other things would they have done? So they'd make like the foundation and Bradwell R&D and all of the stuff making new technologies. So the idea that this was a thing that was very inspired by like British things around the world. So brutalism is actually quite an egalitarian, it was designed as like an egalitarian sort of architecture style, so that it was this place where like anything can happen and everyone should be equal and like everyone should have an opportunity to like use our technologies and it should be everywhere and, you know, for everyone sort of thing. All of that kind of core of like who the Bradwells are as a family, and you get to know who they are through the game. We've tried to embed that in every part of the game, from the architecture to the things you'll see around, to the emails you'll read, all of that sort of stuff. So very British.
It's in a way, it's like what we like to say is, you know, if the Amstrads and the, was it the Sinclairs would have never stopped, that sort of like thing, you know, that's a thing, like, you know, I mean, and the Britishness of it as well, like, it's a nice history as well that you can easily imagine, like, you know, if they would have gone on forever, in that sort of like sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I love the look of it. It's, it looks wonderful and I've really enjoyed playing through it. It looks like it's going to be a fabulous game, so I'm really up for playing more of it when it comes out.
You have no idea how good these words are to hear after 2.5 years of like, we are doing this in quiet.
Yes, I can imagine.
Nobody like sitting there now underpants, like maybe like more dressed than this, but just like trying to get this game out.
What's been the toughest thing for you developing the game?
The balance of it all, like we've got two game mechanics in the game. We've got we've got the photo mechanic, we've got the substance mobile printer, the 3D printing mechanic, we've got the story that we wanted to tell. And combining this all was, I think, the toughest challenge in itself, like, because we wanted to, all the game mechanics and the photo mode and everything that weaved into the story, they're not just like tacked on, and just making sure that everything is coherent and makes sense from the game mechanics to the world. What Holly mentioned, like, you know, we want to create this world that's believable, and getting the balance right was the toughest thing, because we started off, I mean, the nice thing about looking back, because I found an old notebook where I'd written like what I wanted this game to be like way, way before, and it still keeps that core thing. But, you know, we went through many iterations of the story and even like which the chapters and what you do and how much do we do this mechanic, how much do we do that mechanic. And we've been prototyping a lot, and it became, even when we were like in production, it became a lot of like, how much do we need to go to one bit and how much do we need to go to the other bit and how do we feed it all together? And that's just been the longest
toughest sort of like challenge. And ultimately, I think it's, you know, you've played this for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just two chapters. So,
yeah.
So, you know, there is like, when we started it, I said, well, I think originally it was, let's just make a small game. And then,
Yeah, it was going to be, we were going to make it in a year, and it was going to be, you know, like a couple of hours to play through. And then once we actually started working on what we wanted the story to be and this idea of like you were uncovering this mystery, you realized actually this needs a lot of time to breathe, and the mechanics we wanted to explore and the building the relationship with Amber, all of that was going to need a lot more time than we had initially thought, you know, we would spend on it. And ultimately it's all turned out for the best. And the wonderful thing is like the team size and the people on the team have changed quite a lot over time. Like for one point there were only three of us, and now I think we're about seven or eight people who are on full time. And so these people have like come in at different points where we've been able to show them the game, and they'll have like a new insight on it and being like, oh, did you think about maybe this? And you're, and we'd just be like, no, we've been on this for like 2 years, we did not think of that. And we've had like a really wonderful thing where people, new collaborators, have been able to come in and be able to like bring their own perspective on it, their own experiences and their own expertise into it, and then we've been able to make a much stronger game because of all these people who have come on board. And so it's definitely been like a really nice group collaboration. So whilst you're only speaking to the two of us here, it's definitely everyone who's worked on it has like a fingerprint in it somewhere of like they brought their own unique thing to it and wouldn't have been possible without all of their contributions. So it's been a really nice supportive collaborative group actually making it as well. And we've been like really diverse in terms of in terms of like where everyone's from. Like we've got people from the UK, we've got people from all over Europe. We've been about 50-50% on like gender, so we've had a lot of women working on it, which I think has just given it its really its own style and unique perspective, I think, which I think makes it a really interesting game for people to play because there's not really anything kind of like it, I think.
Yeah, and I think all of us, our key thing was we wanted to make a really fun an immersive experience that's believable. I think that was it. You know, it doesn't have to be realistic, it just has to be believable, that sort of thing. And yeah, so I'm glad that you played through.
I had great fun with it. It's hugely entertaining. I love the humour in it. I love the Britishness of it. It's definitely one that I will be playing more of. I can see myself wasting hours on it. So yes, definitely.
It's not racing, it's an investment. It's an investment.
Of course, yes. Sorry. Yes, of course it is.
Of your time, yeah. You know.
So if people want to know more about it, where can they find more information?
Yeah, so our website is www.thebradwellconspiracy.com. So you will find a lot of it's our sort of like it's also an interesting website, not just about the game but also about Bradwell Electronics. Right. We've done a lot of that. You've learned a lot of that as well. And yeah, that will be the best starting point. Or you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us individually on Twitter, like Holly's at HollyPixel. I'm just giving out your Twitter handle here. And I'm at George Backer. That's George with an E, Eddie. Bossa Studios. Oh, yeah, Bossa Studios is a good one to follow as well. But my Twitter handle, it's George without the E at the end. George Backer without the E at the end. It's very complicated. But I think the website is the best start, and Bossa Studios as well. They're the publishers.
Has he got Steam page as well?
Yes, you can currently go on to Steam and search for The Bradwell Conspiracy, and you can wishlist that now so you can get updates on, you know, when is there a release date. And
yeah, no, that's I just realised. Obviously, the most important thing is like wishlist it on Steam. We've got a Steam page. Sorry, you told me, I was like, what am I doing? Forget the private print fans. Nobody cares.
Awesome. Well, it's lovely to talk to you. I'm very much looking forward to it coming out.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
So that was the interview with George Backer and Holly Pickering from A Brave Plan, who make the Bradwell Conspiracy. You can find more about that on the bradwellconspiracy.com, the Bradwell Electronics website, which is bradwellelectronics.com. You can also go to Steam. If you look up the Bradwell Conspiracy on Steam, they've got a Steam page. You can follow it on there and put it on your wish list and subscribe for updates and all that sort of stuff. But I think they're talking about getting it out next year. So well worth waiting for that, though. It looks fabulous. Anything else from EGX, or are we all done?
I could talk for about another 6 hours about EGX. I think we'll call that our highlights for now.
Yes.
And crack on with the TV and film news.
Yes, I think that's probably a good idea. TV and film news this week, a few renewals, cancellations and pickups. Dietland, which goes out on Amazon over here, that has been cancelled after one season, which is a bit of a shame. The Deuce has been renewed for a third and final season. I've been enjoying that. It's been quite a good show, quite an interesting sort of quite dark drama, HBO drama that, but that's coming back for a third and final season. They've announced the air date for Daredevil season 3. That's coming on Friday the 19th of October. You can watch the... I think this is the first year they've actually done four shows in one year as well, which is quite good. They've managed to get Daredevil, sneak Daredevil in. And Hulu also announced they're reviving Veronica Mars for a brand new fourth season, 8 episodes straight to series order. New season will see the spring breakers being murdered in the town of Neptune, decimating the seaside town's lifeblood tourist industry. So that's good. I don't know, were you a fan of Veronica Mars? It was a series that bypassed me entirely and I really want to go and watch
it. I don't think I've seen a single episode of it actually.
It's difficult to find over here. I did go looking. You can buy it on Amazon, but it's not like on any of the streaming services at the moment.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it on any of the versions I have either. But it seems to have quite a big following. Maybe a lot of people are getting the Blu-rays and DVDs.
Yeah, maybe. So, but you can go and buy it if you want to stream it off Amazon. It's not on Amazon Prime. So moving on to the bigger news, Netflix are working on a live action Avatar The Last Airbender series. And I know a lot of people will probably groan at this, but the good news is the original creators are the people behind it. So I think that's probably quite positive.
Also, the bar that's been set by live action.
Yes.
Like movies for The Last Airbender is so low.
Yes, yes.
The
M. Night Shyamalan 2010 movie did not go down well with fans, I seem to remember.
No, I feel sorry for the people involved because some of the visuals in that movie were very nice, but they tried to cram in an entire series into a film with nowhere near enough time for any of the storylines to breathe or any of the characters to develop or anything to really even kind of half make sense. It was just sort of poor overall plan that meant the foundation was really shaky to start with. And with something that's as beloved as a series like that, you have to do a good job or the fans will have you and you'll basically end up with something that's like Dragon Ball Evolution on your hands.
Yeah, this sounds like it's in the right place with the right people behind it. I mean, it's Netflix. I think they're probably going to do a good job with it. It's got the original creators. They are the people behind the new show. So it's not just like a token gesture. They are the people behind it. And they've also made a specific point about having a non-whitewashed cast, because that was one of the accusations that was thrown at the movie as well. So that, I think, is probably quite a positive thing. If you're not aware of The Last Airbender, it was an animated series that was on Nickelodeon, I think, originally. Sort of taken on a life of its own since then. It's become incredibly popular.
Yeah, it's incredibly well-written, detailed, well-fleshed-out world, because you've got your different nations for water, air and fire, and the politics between them all. It's incredibly nuanced for what was pitched as a children's show, and it has as many adult fans as children's fans. And it's a family show where different ages get something different from it. And it draws a lot from sort of Japanese style and a lot from the kind of Studio Ghibli approach, especially with the animals and the worlds and things. But it's an American production by Nickelodeon, animated in Korea mostly. And it's so depth and so well made, that, and it's a huge world. So I can see that if they're not just retelling the animated series, if they're building on it, there's plenty of material and extra stuff that they could do with it.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like a really sort of interesting thing. It's not a show which I particularly know very well, but having read the background to it, I'm very interested to see certainly the live action version. I don't know whether the animated series is on Netflix at the moment, but if not, I imagine they will be when this comes out.
I would advise watching it, like the way it handles, because you obviously have the Avatar, who is one born to every generation or so, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There's only one chosen. And the responsibility falls on them to master all four of the nation's power bases, because they can control the element. And they are kind of the guardian that keeps the balance in the world. And this falls to Aang, who is a young boy who is completely on his own. He's sort of been frozen in time for a very long time. And the way they deal with the responsibility on such young shoulders and the development of all the characters is really incredible. It's one of those things where I was epically hooked on it and I've binge-watched a lot of it, and I never watched it.
Yeah, it looks like a very interesting series to come up, and I'm just glad that they seem to have it in the right hands, you know, and in the right place. So yeah, I think that's quite good news. Sticking with streaming services, Disney are apparently considering a live-action Loki and a live-action Scarlet Witch series for their new streaming service. They're actually considering a whole bunch of these. Those are the two that have been particularly named. But the idea is that they would take... This is not recasting Loki or recasting Scarlet Witch. This is companion series to the MCU, taking some of the characters from the MCU, giving them their own TV series on a limited basis. So it's essentially a sort of anthology series that takes some of the MCU characters, you know, not the big guys that have their own movies, but some of the smaller guys. I mean, though Loki arguably isn't that much of a smaller guy, but, you know, taking some of the characters that maybe wouldn't get entirely their own movie and giving them a TV show for one season and then doing one season with another character. That seems to be what they're sort of looking at doing. So Loki and Scarlet Witch are the two that they've mentioned so far.
I think you know what my vote's going to be.
You would just have a Loki series on constantly. I know you.
Yeah, I was sad that we never got a Loki movie because there was certainly fan demand for it.
Yes.
It's going to be the most expensive limited series. It's going to be limited series with an unlimited budget. I've never really particularly liked this incarnation of Scarlet Witch. I'm not keen on the writing of the character. So that one I'm less fussed by, but that would at least be slightly more plausible budget-wise. But it's an interesting idea, and if they can make the money for it and they think they can get a return on that investment, I think it's a really interesting way of kind of tying together maybe things happening between movies or things that happen off-scene, because you've got so many of these big movies now where we've got so many characters in. It might be cool to fill in some of the gaps of what was happening when we were following someone else.
Yeah, I think that would be a really interesting idea. I like the idea of this. They've not really done TV stuff that ties directly into the films. I mean, we've had Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which obviously used Phil Coulson, who had been in the films and is in the upcoming Captain Marvel movie. We've had that, but we've not really had major direct crossover with a TV series of sort of, you know, you had Lady Sif, I think, popped up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And,
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. occasionally would do things like they'd turn up to clean up what happened at the end of the Thor movie.
Yeah, but most of the Marvel TV universe doesn't have any direct movie relation. You know, there's been references in Daredevil.
It's a companion series.
Yeah, they don't have character crossovers. So I think it's literally taking characters out of the MCU movies and dropping them into their own TV show. I think is quite an interesting idea. Where else they could go with this? I mean, Falcon maybe is a TV limited run. Winter Soldier maybe is a limited run, will be an interesting one. Vision and Scarlet Witch sitcom. I don't know.
That's my idea of hell, that one. Sorry, guys. It opens up a lot of doors.
Yeah, it could be quite interesting to see what they do with that, particularly as the movies are moving into this kind of new phase. You may start seeing some characters pop up there which are used a little bit in the films, and then maybe they have their own series that does their own thing. So
yeah, it might be nice to have a series about Shuri, that band of sisters. It could be just all the tech chaos going on behind the scenes.
Yes, that could be quite good. Yeah, there's enough sort of more minor characters to pick from, I think, that you could make some interesting shows. Like I say, at the moment, this was a sort of rumour that came out. We don't know whether it's going to happen or not. It seems to be some ideas. They came from fairly reliable sources. I mean, it was on Variety, that was the website that broke it. So they've not had anything official from Disney, but it would seem like it is something they're mulling over at the moment. Doesn't mean they've actually been commissioned. Streaming service itself isn't going to launch in the USA until the end of next year. It'll then be rolled out worldwide, which is more than we know from the DC side of things, because they won't say anything about what they're doing with that internationally. So the Disney streaming service, they've said, is going to go out worldwide after the US launch date, but if it's not going to be until the end of 2019, it could be 2020 before they launch it outside the US. So we'll have to wait and see, but hopefully they don't wait too long, because there's a live action Star Wars series coming on there, and that's going to get pirated to death if they don't launch that at the same time worldwide. We'll have to see what ends up on there, but end of next year for that. So that's all the news we've got for this week. As we did the interviews earlier, there's no other interview this week, so we're going to move straight on to highlights for next week on TV. So, highlights for next week on TV. We have The Last Ship, Season 5. That's finally coming back. That's coming to Sky One on the 26th of September at 9 p.m. They're starting to put things back together and everything falls apart again. So, that's the fifth and final season of that show, because I don't think they can throw any more things at that boat. So, that's coming back on the 26th of September at 9 p.m. I'm very much looking forward to that. South Park, Season 22. That starts on Comedy Central on the 27th of September at 10 p.m. So more from them. American Horror Apocalypse. I know that's a huge show this year. Well, huge show every year, but it particularly seems to be quite big this year. That is coming on the 27th of September at 10 p.m. Sick of It, which is the new scripted comedy starring Carl Pilkington as him and his subconscious, I guess. There's sort of two of him and him talking to himself. Sky One, that comes to you on the 27th of September at 10 p.m. That looks like it could be quite interesting, so watch out for that. And another show with two versions of the same person in as well, weirdly, Counterpart. Season one of that starts on Stars Play on the 28th of September. That stars J.K. Simmons as Howard Silk, who is a cog in the seemingly innocuous UN agency. He discovers there is actually guarding a path to a parallel dimension. Already has a second season order of 10 episodes, which I think are coming fairly soon. Season one of that is on Stars Play, which is that add-on channel which comes onto Amazon Prime, 28th of September for that. The Good Place also arrives for its third season on the 28th of September. This is one of the best sitcoms you could watch. Hilariously funny. I don't want to explain any of it right now because I don't want to spoil anything if you've not watched any of it. Go watch The Good Place. It's superb. It is one of the funniest, if not the funniest sitcom on TV right now. 28th of September on Netflix for that. So that's everything for this week. If you want to find Bex, you can find her at...
Check out Trista Bytes, spelled like computer bytes, because I'm WPP on YouTube.com. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and my articles and videos sometimes pop up on the Geek Town website as well.
That's where you can find Bex. For us, if you want to visit the website, you can go to geektown.co.uk throughout the week and see all the latest air date info. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram at geektownuk. That's everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.